Welcome back, everybody, for another deep dive with us. Today we are going to be tackling a case that really gets to the heart of a tricky issue, and that's reverse redlining.
Absolutely.
So you're probably familiar with the idea of redlining, denying services to certain areas based on race or ethnicity.
Yeah.
Reverse redlining is different.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about denying services, but rather about targeting specific groups with predatory lending practices.
Right.
So imagine being pushed towards loans with outrageous interest rates and fees just because of where you live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reality of reverse redlining. And we're going to see how it played out in the case of McGlaughan versus PHRC.
Yeah, it's a landmark case that really sheds light on how state laws can be used to combat this very insidious form of discrimination.
All right, so let's set the stage.
Okay.
Who are the McGlaughans?
Okay.
And what exactly were they accused of?
So the McGlaughans ran a mortgage brokerage firm in Pennsylvania and were accused of targeting African-American borrowers in Philadelphia with predatory loans. The Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission, or PHRC, brought the case against them.
So what made their lending practices so predatory?
Right.
In the source material, there was mention of a woman named Lucretia Taylor, who was given a loan with an 8.75% interest rate plus 10 points.
Wow.
That's a hefty sum.
Absolutely. To put it in perspective, the PHRC presented evidence showing that the prevailing rate for similar loans at the time was significantly lower.
Okay.
And Ms. Taylor's case wasn't an isolated incident either.
Right.
The commission's investigation uncovered a clear pattern of African-American borrowers being charged higher rates and fees compared to those in other areas.
That sounds like a pretty strong case for predatory lending.
Yeah.
But wasn't there a two-pronged test that the courts used to determine if reverse redlining occurred?
Yes. To prove reverse redlining, you need to demonstrate both predatory lending practices and targeting based on race.
All right.
In this case, the PHRC not only showed the predatory nature of the loans themselves, but also how the McGlaughans targeted African-American borrowers. And they did this by analyzing marketing materials and demographic data, revealing a clear pattern of loans concentrated in predominantly African-American neighborhoods.
So even without a blatant memo saying target these communities, the data itself painted a pretty damning picture.
Exactly. And this case really highlights the power of data analysis in proving disparate impact, showing how lending practices disproportionately harm a particular racial group, even without explicitly discriminatory policies.
The Pennsylvania Human Relations Act, or the PHRA,
mm-hmm.
played a big role in this case, right?
Absolutely. The PHRA explicitly prohibits discrimination in any loan terms based on race, color, religious creed, ancestry, age, sex, national origin, or disability.
Wow.
It actually provides broader protection than federal laws like the Fair Housing Act.
Oh, wow. So even though federal laws exist, state laws like the PHRA can offer an additional layer of protection for borrowers.
Absolutely.
That's an important takeaway for legal professionals dealing with these types of cases.
Yeah, it's crucial to understand the interplay between state and federal laws in some cases, like McGlaughan state law, might offer a more effective avenue for pursuing claims of lending discrimination.
Okay, so the court ultimately found that the McGlaughans had engaged in reverse redlining, right?
Yeah.
What were the consequences?
Yes, the court upheld the commission's findings.
Mm-hmm.
They were ordered to stop their discriminatory practices and fined $25,000. However, the case took an interesting turn when it came to calculating damages for the victims.
What happened with the damages?
Okay.
It seems straightforward. Just figure out how much borrowers were overcharged.
Initially, the commission calculated damages based on a hypothetical 5% fair interest rate, comparing that to what borrowers actually paid.
Okay.
So essentially, they said this is how much you were overcharged, but the court rejected that approach, arguing for a more individualized assessment.
Why did the court reject that seemingly logical approach?
Yeah. The court said that using a blanket 5% rate didn't account for the specific circumstances of each borrower, like their credit history, the market conditions at the time, and the availability of alternative loans. They wanted a more nuanced analysis reflecting the actual harm suffered by each individual.
So calculating damages in reverse redlining cases is more complex than it might appear on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a simple math equation.
Exactly. It requires a thorough examination of individual circumstances and market factors. And this case highlighted that complexity, potentially leaving us with more questions than answers when it comes to quantifying the true cost of these discriminatory practices.
This whole issue of damage calculation really makes me wonder about the long-term consequences. You know, we're talking about real people's lives here.
Right.
What are the lasting effects of these predatory practices, not just on individuals, but on entire communities?
The damage caused by reverse redlining runs deep. It goes beyond individual financial hardship, impacting entire communities, and contributing to a cycle of poverty and inequality. What? Imagine a neighborhood targeted by predatory lenders as more people fall into debt traps. They struggle to make payments, leading to foreclosures.
Right.
This destabilizes property values, erodes the tax base, and makes it harder for the community to invest in essential services like schools and infrastructure.
So it's a domino effect that weakens the entire community, mm-hmm. not just those directly targeted by the predatory loans.
Precisely. And often the community's hardest hit are those already facing systemic disadvantages, like communities of color or low-income neighborhoods. They might face barriers accessing traditional financial services, making them more vulnerable to predatory lenders in the first place. It's a vicious cycle.
That brings us to another crucial aspect of this conversation, and that's the role of data. We talked about how data was key in the McGlaughan case, especially improving disparate impact.
Right.
But what happens when that data isn't available?
That's a major obstacle in fighting reverse redlining. Unlike the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, or HMDA, which mandates data collection for mortgage applications, there's no federal law requiring that level of data collection for all types of loans. Okay.
This lack of comprehensive data can make proving disparate impact incredibly difficult.
So without that granular data on loan applications, it becomes much harder to show a lender is disproportionately harming specific groups.
Right.
Even if we suspect it's happening.
Exactly. And that's a real concern. If we can't see the patterns, we can't address the problem. Many fair lending advocates argue for expanding data collection requirements for all lenders, regardless of the loan type. This would give regulators a much clearer picture of lending practices, enabling them to identify red flags and intervene earlier.
That makes sense, but I can also see the other side of the argument. Wouldn't that raise concerns about privacy?
Yeah.
Collecting more data on people's financial lives could feel intrusive, even if it's meant to combat discrimination.
It's a valid concern. Any expansion of data collection would need to be done carefully with robust safeguards to protect privacy. But I believe the potential benefits for combating discrimination outweigh the risks. More comprehensive data would empower us to address these issues directly and create a more equitable lending market for everyone. It seems like a delicate balance to strike, needing enough data to expose discrimination, but not so much that it feels like an invasion of privacy. Speaking of balancing act, what about the role of subprime lending in general?
Right.
It's also portrayed as inherently predatory.
Yeah.
But is there a legitimate need for these types of loans in the market?
That's a complex question that sparks debate among economists and policymakers. Some argue subprime loans can provide access to credit for borrowers who might not qualify for traditional loans, people with lower credit scores or limited credit history. These loans could help them achieve homeownership, start businesses, or cover unexpected expenses, promoting financial inclusion.
So there's an argument for expanding access to credit, even if it comes with higher risks.
Right. However, even responsibly managed subprime loans carry inherent risks. The higher interest rates and fees can be difficult to afford, especially for borrowers already struggling financially. And when lenders engage in predatory practices like deceptive marketing or steering borrowers into unaffordable loans, the consequences can be devastating.
It sounds like a classic double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Subprime lending could help some people, but also creates opportunities for exploitation and abuse.
Absolutely.
That's where regulation becomes so important, right?
Absolutely. We need clear rules and strong enforcement to ensure lenders act responsibly and borrowers are treated fairly. Finding the right balance between promoting access to credit while protecting borrowers from predatory practices is a challenge, but a necessary one.
It reminds me of our conversation about data collection, another area where we need to find that delicate balance. This whole discussion makes me think about the role of technology specifically in creating more inclusive and equitable lending models that don't rely solely on traditional credit scores. Could we use alternative data sources or machine learning to assess creditworthiness in a fairer way? Perhaps that could bridge the gap between responsible lending and expanded access. That's a promising avenue that many fintech companies are exploring. The traditional credit scoring system has been criticized for perpetuating biases and excluding certain groups using alternative data like rental payment history or utility bills could paint a more accurate and nuanced picture of a borrower's financial health.
It's exciting to think about how technology might help us rethink creditworthiness and build a more inclusive financial system, but we need to approach it cautiously. Right.
Absolutely. We need to ensure that technology used in lending is ethical and benefits all borrowers, not just a select few. Algorithmic bias is a real concern, as is the risk of exacerbating existing inequalities if not implemented thoughtfully.
Before we move on, I'm curious, are there any potential upsides to subprime lending when done responsibly? Could it be a path towards economic mobility for those who might not otherwise have access to traditional credit?
That's a great question. There are potential benefits to consider, even with the inherent risks. Some argue subprime loans can help individuals build credit history, which can be a stepping stone to accessing other financial products and services in the future.
So it's like a pathway to financial stability, but only if it's handled responsibly on both sides.
Exactly. Transparency and education are key. Borrowers need to fully understand the terms and have a realistic repayment plan. Lenders need to ensure borrowers aren't steered into loans they can't afford or that don't align with their financial goals.
So open communication, clear disclosures, and a commitment to responsible lending practices are essential. It's not just about the numbers, it's about people's lives and financial well-being.
I agree. It's about creating a system that works for everyone, not just a select few. We need to ensure that lending practices are fair, transparent, and accessible to all, regardless of their background.
This conversation about responsible lending practices makes me think about the role of individual borrowers. What can people do to protect themselves from predatory lending, especially in a market where these practices can be so subtle?
Awareness is key. The more informed borrowers are, the better equipped they'll be to protect themselves. Educate yourself about predatory lending practices. Be wary of high-pressure sales tactics or confusing loan terms. Know your rights and don't hesitate to ask questions.
So it's about being an empowered consumer and taking control of your financial decisions.
Exactly. Don't jump at the first loan offer that comes your way. Shop around and compare rates, fees, and terms from multiple lenders. And don't be afraid to negotiate for better terms. Knowledge is power in this situation.
Are there any other practical steps individuals can take to protect themselves?
Seeking guidance from reputable sources can make a big difference. HUD-approved housing counseling agencies and nonprofit organizations specializing in financial literacy can provide valuable advice and support. They can help you understand the process, avoid pitfalls, and make informed decisions.
Those are great resources for borrowers to know about. And what about the role of communities in this fight? Can collective action make a difference?
Absolutely. Community organizations, faith-based groups, and advocacy groups can play a critical role. They can raise awareness, provide financial education workshops, and advocate for policy changes that protect borrowers. They can also connect individuals with resources and support.
So it's about building a network of support and creating a united front against these harmful practices.
Exactly. When communities join forces, they can amplify their voices and push for a fairer system.
You know, this whole conversation has been incredibly insightful. We've covered so much ground already. The legal nuances of the McGlon case, the broader impact of reverse redlining, the complexities of data collection, the role of technology, and the importance of individual and community action.
It's been a fascinating journey exploring the many facets of this complex issue, and we've still got more to delve into.
You're right. We're going to take a quick break and then come back for the final part of our deep dive into reverse redlining. Stay tuned. Welcome back to our deep dive into reverse redlining. We've been unpacking this complex issue through the lens of the McGlon case, exploring the legal, economic, and social ramifications of these predatory lending practices.
And we've talked about the need for stronger regulations, data collection, and technological innovations to address this problem.
But let's not forget about the human element. What role can individuals and communities play in this fight?
That's a really crucial point. While systemic changes are essential, individual actions matter. It starts with awareness. The more people understand about reverse redlining and its consequences, the better equipped they are to protect themselves and their communities.
So knowledge is power in this situation.
Absolutely. Educating yourself about predatory lending, recognizing red flags like high-pressure sales tactics or confusing loan terms, and knowing your rights as a borrower can go a long way.
What other practical steps can individuals take?
Shopping around for loans is critical. Don't jump at the first offer. Compare interest rates, fees, and terms from multiple lenders, and don't be afraid to ask questions and negotiate.
It's about being an informed and empowered consumer, not just passively accepting whatever is offered.
Exactly. Another important step is seeking guidance from reputable sources. HUD-approved housing counseling agencies or nonprofit organizations specializing in financial literacy can provide valuable advice and support.
Those are resources everyone should know about. Now, shifting gears to the community level, can collective action truly make a difference in combating reverse redlining?
Absolutely. Community organizations, faith-based groups, and advocacy groups are vital. They can raise awareness, provide financial education workshops, and advocate for policy changes to protect borrowers.
So it's about creating a united front against these harmful practices.
Exactly. When communities work together, their voices are amplified, creating a more powerful force for change.
You know, our discussion so far has been very informative, but somewhat abstract. It's important to remember that behind the data and legal arguments are real people whose lives are deeply impacted by these practices.
I agree. Sharing personal stories helps humanize the issue, making it more relatable and inspiring action.
The story of Lucretia Taylor, who was charged that exorbitant interest rate, is a stark reminder of the human cost of reverse redlining.
Yeah, her experience and the countless others like it underscore why this fight is so important. Everyone deserves access to fair and affordable credit, regardless of their background.
We've explored many aspects of reverse redlining today. The McGlawn case data collection, the role of technology, individual, and community action, as we wrap up this deep dive. I want to leave our listeners with a sense of hope this isn't an insurmountable problem.
I'm optimistic as well. With persistence, education, and a collective commitment to justice, we can create a more equitable financial system for everyone.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you found it informative and empowering. Remember, the conversation doesn't end here. Keep exploring these issues, challenge the status quo, and use your voice to advocate for a fairer world. Until next time, stay curious and stay engaged. Welcome back to our deep dive on reverse redlining. You know, we've been unpacking this complex issue through the lens of the McGlawn case and exploring, you know, all the different ramifications of it.
The legal, the economic, the social.
Exactly. And, you know, we've talked about the need for, you know, stronger regulations,
right,
data collection, technological innovations to really address this problem.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not forget about the human element, right?
Yeah.
What role can individuals and communities play in this fight?
That's a crucial point. You know, while these big systemic changes are really essential, individual actions really do matter. And it all starts with awareness. You know, the more people understand about reverse redlining and its consequences, the better equipped they'll be to protect themselves and their communities.
So knowledge is power.
Absolutely. Educating yourself about predatory lending, you know, recognizing those red flags like the high pressure sales tactics,
right, yeah,
the confusing loan terms, knowing your rights as a borrower can go a long way.
So what other practical steps can individuals take?
Well, shopping around for loans is critical.
Okay.
Don't just jump at the first offer that comes your way. You know, compare interest rates, fees, and terms from multiple lenders. And don't be afraid to ask questions and negotiate for something better.
It's about being an informed consumer.
Exactly, an empowered consumer, not just passively accepting whatever's offered.
Right, not being taken advantage of.
Exactly. And another important step is seeking guidance from reputable sources.
Yeah.
You know, HUD-approved housing counseling agencies or those nonprofit organizations that specialize in financial literacy can provide really valuable advice and support.
Those are great resources.
Yeah.
That everybody should know about. Now, shifting gears a little bit to the community level,
yeah,
can collective action truly make a difference in combating reverse redlining?
Absolutely. Community organizations, you know, those faith-based groups, advocacy yeah, groups are really vital. They can raise awareness, they can provide those financial education workshops, and they can really advocate for policy changes to protect borrowers.
So it's about creating that united front against these harmful practices.
Exactly. You know, when communities work together, their voices are amplified and it creates a much more powerful force for change.
Our discussion so far has been very informative, but it's been somewhat abstract.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to remember that behind all the data and the legal arguments are real people whose lives are deeply impacted by these practices.
I agree. And sharing personal stories, you know, helps humanize the issue.
Yeah.
It makes it more relatable and it can really inspire action.
And the story of Lucretia Taylor,
mm-hmm,
who was charged that really exorbitant interest rate.
Right.
It's a stark reminder of the human cost of reverse redlining.
Yeah. Her experience and countless others, like, it really underscore why this fight is so important. Everyone deserves access to fair and affordable credit, regardless of their background or where they live.
You know, we've explored so many different aspects of reverse redlining today. The McGlawn case, you know, the data collection,
right,
the role of technology, individual community action. And I think as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave our listeners with a sense of hope this isn't an insurmountable problem.
I'm optimistic as well. I think with persistence and education and a collective commitment to justice, we can create a more equitable financial system for everyone.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into reverse redlining. We hope you found it informative and empowering. And remember, the conversation doesn't end here. Keep exploring these issues, challenge the status quo, and use your voice to advocate for a fairer world. Until next time, stay curious and stay engaged.